Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the October 27th, 2023 issue of the Week. The cover of this week's issue is actually a photograph instead of a drawing. It's a scene of a bombing in Gaza. The buildings are destroyed, rubble everywhere. In the foreground, a man with blood on his forehead is carrying a woman who's obviously in agony, and she's got blood on her face as well. There's a man off to the left pointing and shouting to someone. In the background, there are people just every direction working through the rubble. Ironically, the background is a beautiful, clear blue sky. The headline is Agony in Gaza. Israel is determined to destroy Hamas, but at what price? And that is our first main story. We'll start there. Biden visits Israel as rage grows over hospital blast. What happened? President Biden landed in Tel Aviv this week in a dramatic show of solidarity with Israel amid its war with Hamas, even as anger rose in the Middle East over a devastating explosion at a Gaza hospital. Hamas and Israel traded blame for the blast, which Gazan authorities said killed at least 500 Palestinians, many of whom were sheltering there to escape shelling that has turned entire neighborhoods to rubble. Hamas claimed the explosion was caused by an Israeli missile strike. Israel said it was the result of a failed rocket launch by the terrorist group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. U.S. officials said that after examining video and satellite data, they had high confidence Israel was not responsible for the blast. It appears as though it was done by the other team, not you, Biden said during a public meeting with Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu. His visit came 10 days after Hamas terrorists massacred some 1,400 Israelis and kidnapped 200 more in a surprise attack. At least 3,000 Palestinians have been killed by Israel's retaliatory operation in Gaza, according to Palestinian authorities. The hospital explosion sparked mass protests across the region. King Abdullah II of Jordan called it a heinous war crime that cannot be ignored and canceled a summit where he and other Middle Eastern leaders were slated to meet with Biden. The hospital casualties compounded a growing humanitarian disaster in Gaza. About half the territory's 2 million residents have fled their homes, and many lack food and water. Israel has blocked aid delivery despite growing pressure from international nonprofits, but Biden said it had agreed to allow food, water, and medicine into Gaza through Egypt and announced $100 million in U.S. humanitarian aid. Israel ordered more than a million Palestinians to evacuate northern Gaza in advance of an expected ground invasion, and tens of thousands of Israeli soldiers massed along the border. But an Israeli military spokesman said that while everybody's talking about the ground offensive, the war's next stages might involve something different. In Tel Aviv, Biden delivered a message of support. You are not alone, he told Israelis, but counseled against acting in anger over Hamas's atrocities. While you feel that rage, he said, don't be consumed by it. What the editorial said. Netanyahu has one thing right, said the New York Daily News. The only moral answer to the murders, kidnappings, and rapes Hamas inflicted on innocent Israelis is to eradicate the evil organization root and branch. But that doesn't give Israel license to run roughshod over innocent civilians. Inflicting mass casualties will just fuel hatred and dash any hopes of long-term coexistence between Israelis and Palestinians. Threading the needle is going to be exceedingly difficult, but Israel must do its best. Israel has an obligation to do what it can to protect civilians, said the Wall Street Journal. But because Hamas places its weapons and fighters in highly populated areas, using innocent Palestinians as human shields, it's inevitable that some civilians will die. The world must remember that the responsibility for those deaths will lie with Hamas. To blame Israel amounts to denying the Jewish state the right to self-defense and granting Hamas a terrorist sanctuary from which it can attack Israel at will. What the columnist said. Biden's unequivocal support for Israel marks his finest hour, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times, by forcefully calling out Hamas' barbarism and asserting Israel's duty to defend itself. He offered moral clarity amid darkness and told devastated Jews what they desperately needed to hear. As misguided leftists denounce Israel and the American right drifts in an ethical void, Biden bravely traveled to Tel Aviv to console the bereaved and give courage to those in fear. This is what American moral leadership looks like. Instead of waving an Israeli flag, Biden must use his leverage to stop our ally from blundering into a profoundly misbegotten war, said Mark Lynch in Foreign Affairs. A Gaza invasion would be a humanitarian, moral, and strategic catastrophe. It would not only inflict unfathomable costs on Palestinians, but also risk a protracted quagmire and a conflict that could spread to the West Bank, Lebanon, and beyond. Only the Biden administration can save Israel from itself. Meanwhile, rage at Israel and its staunch ally, the U.S., is surging across the Middle East, said Karim Fahim in the Washington Post. Mounting public revulsion at the spiraling Palestinian death toll exploded after the hospital blast, sending protesters to the streets from Morocco to Iran. In Beirut, demonstrators lit fires outside the U.S. embassy and were dispersed with tear gas. The public mood is hotter than it's been in a very, very long time, said London-based security studies expert H.A. Hellyer. The fury in Israel is palpable as well, said David Remnick in The New Yorker. After days there speaking to Israelis, I find it difficult to convey the overall sense of dread and rage and the intensity of the demands for vengeance. It's understandable, but it must be resisted. Israel must defend itself, but will answering cruelty with accelerating cruelty make Israelis safe? A campaign born of rage will not end well, and countless lives on both sides of the fence are at stake. Controversy of the week. Israel at war. Is it violating international law in Gaza? Hamas massacre of more than 1,400 Israelis shocked the world, said Sari Bashi in MSNBC.com. But war crimes by one party don't justify war crimes by the other. International law prohibits the collective punishment of civilian populations. Yet Israel is relentlessly pummeling the densely populated Gaza Strip with airstrikes and artillery, killing more than 3,000 Palestinians, many of them children, and wounding at least 12,500 others. And as a result of what Israel calls its complete siege of Gaza, the Hamas-run territory's 2 million residents are running out of food, water, medicines, and the diesel that hospitals need to run generators. Israel may also be conducting ethnic cleansing, said Kenneth Roth in The Guardian. It has ordered 1.1 million Palestinians to leave their homes in northern Gaza, ostensibly to avoid civilian casualties in a ground invasion. But this demand will only compound the humanitarian catastrophe in southern Gaza, while expanding, illegally, the territory controlled by Israel. The West can't let this happen. While our governments are defending Israel's unquestionable right to respond to Hamas' vicious assault, they must condition their support on Israel agreeing to abide by the laws of war. Those laws, as codified by the Geneva Conventions, are perfectly cleared, says Eugene Kontrovich in the Wall Street Journal. Civilians must never be directly targeted, the way Hamas targeted Israelis on October 7th. But the possibility of civilian death doesn't negate a nation's right to defend itself. Israel's siege of Gaza is a perfectly legal military tactic aimed at weakening Hamas, which has violated international law by deliberately hiding its control centers and weapons caches in schools, hospitals, and apartment buildings. Israel takes great pains to avoid civilian casualties, said Mona Shirin in The Bulwark, but Hamas wants its citizens to die at the hands of Israelis. Horrifying images of dead children in rubble fuel the regional rage that helps fill Hamas coffers, while making Western nations forget their sympathy for Israel and demand the killing stop. If the Israeli military is pursuing a military objective with maximal restraint, said Raz Segal in Jewish Currents, why are Israel's leaders speaking the language of genocide? Announcing the cruel blockade of supplies to Gaza, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said, we are fighting human animals, and we are acting accordingly. Israeli President Isaac Herzog said the entire nation of Gaza is to blame for October 7th. While other members of Israel's parliament are explicitly calling for the mass expulsion of Palestinians and for doomsday weapons to be used on Gaza. Is it even possible to wipe out Hamas through military action? Asked Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Or has Israel turned Gaza, already one of the poorest places on earth, into a living hell in an understandable but illegal act of revenge? Israel does have an attainable military objective, said The Economist in an editorial. Speaking off the record, IDF officials say the goal is to free Israeli hostages, seize Gaza City, eliminate Hamas' top political and military leadership in the territory, and destroy as much of its military capacity as possible. The question is whether this justifies a humanitarian crisis that's worsening by the hour. Legally, perhaps, said David French in the New York Times, the challenge for Israeli soldiers, though, isn't simply to win the fight with Hamas within the laws of war. It is to do so without resorting to barbarism and destroying the very soul of the nation they're fighting to defend. It was a good week for deterrence after Connor Cato of Georgia recorded doing 90 miles per hour in a 55 mile per hour zone, was issued a computer-generated speeding ticket for $1.4 million. The figure was not a typo, officials told Cato, but a placeholder fine that he had to either pay or challenge in court. It was a good week for loving it after a German couple seeking the ultimate American wedding tied the knot at a McDonald's in Croswell, Michigan, flying in 23 guests from Munich for the ceremony. The experience, said bride Kathy Haller, was so unique and special. It was a good week for shoplifting. After a black bear entered a gas station in British Columbia, perused the candy section, and strolled off with a 50-cent bag of gummy bears in his jaws. Mr. Bear then went out in the parking lot and ate it, said owner Jay DeGosbrand. But it was a bad week for jurisprudence after Oklahoma's top jurist recommended the removal of District Judge Tracy Soderstrom, who sent some 500 text messages to her bailiff during a murder trial, including a claim that one prosecutor had baby hands that are so weird looking. It was a bad week for excess baggage after Japan Airlines added an extra flight for a party of sumo wrestlers headed to a sports festival over concerns the two scheduled planes would not be able to carry sufficient fuel along with dozens of hefty athletes. Finally, it was a bad week for pedagogy after aspiring comedian Steven Taylor was fired from his school teaching job in Kansas for boasting online that he broke wind next to students and also taught them that Abraham Lincoln invented the motor car and that's why it's named after him. This week's briefing, Hamas reign of terror. The October 7th atrocities marked a bloody new chapter in the Palestinian group's four-decade conflict with Israel. What is Hamas? Designated a terrorist organization by the U.S. and dozens of other countries, Hamas controls the Gaza Strip, a sliver of land between Israel and Egypt that's home to some 2 million people. Since its founding in 1987 during the First Intifada, an uprising against Israeli military control of Gaza and the West Bank, Hamas messaging to the outside world has varied, but it has always had one main goal, the violent obliteration of Israel and its replacement by an Islamic society. In face of the Jews' usurpation of Palestine, the group's founding charter declares, it is compulsory that the banner of jihad be raised. An offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas has turned peace talks into bloody uprisings, indoctrinated and trained child soldiers in summer camps, and targeted Israelis with rockets, kidnappings, and suicide bombings. Before the devastating October 7th attacks, Israel had largely resigned itself to trying to weaken and contain Hamas. Now it is pledging to wipe out the terrorist group, which has up to 40,000 fighters. Hamas has shown itself to be an enemy of civilization, said Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Every place from which Hamas operates will turn into ruins. How did Hamas win power in Gaza? Through a combination of brutality and charity. While organizing waves of bloody attacks inside Israel, martyrdom operations that many Palestinians cheered as revenge for their own losses, Hamas founder Sheikh Ahmad Yassin also provided health care, food, and other social services to impoverished Gazans. In the 2006 elections, Hamas won a landslide victory in Gaza over the more moderate Fatah, which controls the West Bank-based Palestinian Authority and is viewed by many Palestinians as a corrupt enabler of Israeli occupation. Fatah refused to cede power, and after a week of violence in 2007, Hamas took total control of Gaza. The era of justice and Islamic rule has arrived, said a spokesman for the Islamist group. Since then, Hamas has fought four wars and countless skirmishes with Israel, further immiserating the territory. What are its typical tactics? In its early years, Hamas used small squads of gunmen and suicide bombers to kill Israeli civilians and soldiers. After Israel assassinated the group's top bomb maker, responsible for at least 90 deaths, with a booby-trapped cell phone in 1996, Hamas retaliated with four suicide bombings. One attack outside a Tel Aviv mall killed 13 people, five of them children. During the second Palestinian uprising from 2000 to 2005, Hamas orchestrated dozens more suicide bombings. One blast killed 15 people, including 5 children, at a Jerusalem pizzeria in 2001. A year later, a bomber killed 30 people at a Passover celebration in Netanya. After Israel withdrew from Gaza in 2005 and sealed off its border to stop infiltrations by Hamas fighters, the group switched tactics and focused on bombarding Israel with rockets and missiles. Its carefully planned slaughter of more than 1,400 Israelis earlier this month marked another sharp change in strategy, one that Israel had not expected. How has Israel tried to contain Hamas? By mowing the lawn. That's the Israeli term for its regular use of airstrikes and limited ground incursions to reduce Hamas military capabilities, operations that often kill civilian bystanders. During the Second Palestinian Uprising, Israel conducted some 200 assassinations. Yassin was killed in a missile strike in 2004. Israel has continued to target Hamas leaders in Gaza and beyond. Mossad agents are suspected of drugging and suffocating military commander Mahmoud al-Mabou in a Dubai hotel room in 2010. More recently, Israel adopted a carrots-and-sticks approach to Hamas, issuing more permits that let Gazans work inside Israel and punishing violence with targeted airstrikes. Despite that bloody status quo, experts say, Hamas may have decided to launch the October 7th attacks in part to derail talks aimed at normalizing relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. That deal was expected to include few concessions to the Palestinians and would have further isolated Hamas' main backer, Iran. What support does Iran provide Hamas? The Shiite nation supplies the Sunni terrorist group with weapons, military training, and some $100 million a year. Iran's most important proxy, the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah, has instructed Hamas on guerrilla warfare since the 1990s. Iran views the Palestinian arena as a major opportunity to promote its vision of surrounding Israel with a ring of fire, said Yaakov Lapin, an Israel-based defense analysis. But Iran is not the only Middle Eastern country that aids Hamas. The group's political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, lives in Qatar, which sends $30 million a month to Gaza to fund public sector wages and stipends for families, and to buy fuel for the territory's sole power plant. Turkey's Islamist president, Tayyip Recep Erdogan, has also pursued friendlier relations with Hamas, and Israel claims has allowed top Hamas leaders to live in his country. Is Hamas popular with Palestinians? It's hard to tell because no elections have been held in Gaza or the West Bank since 2006. A June poll found that many Palestinians are disenchanted with their leadership options. If Hamas Haniyeh and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas were to face off in an election, only 46% of Palestinians would participate. Among those who would cast ballots, 56% would vote for Haniyeh and 33% for Abbas. It's not yet known whether Israel's total siege of Gaza will cause Palestinians to rebel against their Hamas rulers or further radicalize them against Israel. The unfortunate problem is, said Anthony H. Cordesman of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, if you are too thorough in destroying Hamas, you may create a worse successor. Moving into a few of the best columns of the week, we'll start with the issue Biden refuses to address. Voters obviously have profound misgivings about President Biden's age and fitness to serve another term, said Jonathan Martin. But to the enormous frustration of worried Democrats, he refuses to directly confront the biggest threat to his reelection. Sources say Biden complains bitterly about Democrats and pundits who raise the age issue publicly, and is so sensitive about the widespread perception that at 80 he is too old to run again, that advisors are afraid to bring up the topic. Several Senate Democrats and party consultants say Biden needs to make a priority of addressing voters' doubts about his fitness, which now overshadows his many accomplishments. One key Democrat said Biden should sit for a 60 Minutes interview with his wife, Jill, answer every question about his forgetful gaffes and his tripping on stairs, and make the case he loves the country and would never embark on another race if he was not up for it. His standard flippant response to questions about his age, "Watch me," isn't working. Terrified that Donald Trump may reclaim the White House, many Democrats worry Biden is ignoring the flashing red lights, that he's in serious political trouble and will barrel ahead anyway. The dire need for more ammo. In a world where the U.S. has no choice but to defend itself and our allies, we still need artillery shells, lots of artillery shells, said Rich Lowry. Israel's war against Hamas has created a new unexpected demand for U.S. supplied artillery, ammunition, and other weapons. At the same time, 18 months of war in Ukraine has badly depleted existing arsenals. The defense industrial base simply can't keep up, which leaves the U.S. and its democratic allies dangerously vulnerable. After the Cold War ended, the U.S. exploited a peace dividend and scaled back defense spending. But Russia, China, and other rogue states and organizations failed to cooperate, and new conflicts have exposed the pitiful state of our capacity to manufacture the weapons necessary to deter or defeat our adversaries. At the beginning of this year, the U.S. was making 14,500 shells a month, and that number has since doubled. But Ukraine has been firing 6,000 shells a day, and despite sanctions, Russia is producing and firing even more. If China invades Taiwan and the U.S. intervenes, our military could use up all of its long-range anti-ship missiles in a week. Bolstering the domestic capacity to build weapons should be a matter of the highest national priority. This column comes from the UK. It's autumn, and that means hordes of upper-class twits have begun trampling across Britain to shoot pheasants, said George Manbiot. Pheasant season is one of the most abhorrent expressions of class power this country knows, blighting our landscape for the amusement of a tiny minority. It's not a sport. Killing pheasants requires no physical exertion and a limited skill set, as hunters use flushers to drive the birds in low flight directly toward them. And it does immense harm to the ecosystem. The scale of pheasant releases has risen tenfold over the past 60 years, to the point that some 50 million pheasants and 12 million red-legged partridges are now released each year, their combined weight equaling that of all our wild birds put together. Countless foxes, crows, weasels, and stoats are killed to protect the birds, which in turn hoover up vast quantities of insects, flower seeds, and fungi. The antibiotics, often mixed with the feed in pheasants' release pens, are also eaten by wild species, which fuels the growth of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. And the shotgun cartridges contain lead. As much as 6,700 tons of this toxic metal is blasted across the countryside every year. If shooting were the pastime of any class but the posh, it would have been banned long ago. Our feature article, The Last Word, gives us a little break from the stories of war and politics. The headline, the title, The Era of the Neanderthal. Neanderthals died out some 40,000 years ago, said Nikhil Krishnan in The Guardian. New discoveries are changing how we think about our long-scorned hominin relatives and ourselves. There's a human type we've all met. People who find a beleaguered underdog to stick up for. But what if it's too late? Can there be advocates for the extinct? The past few years have seen an abundance of works of popular science about a variety of human beings who once inhabited Eurasia. Neanderthals. They died out, it appears, 40,000 years ago. That number, 40,000, is as totemic to Neanderthal specialists as that better-known figure, 65 million, is to dinosaur fanciers. Some basic facts about the Neanderthals are now pretty well settled. Of the many species of hominin, they were the dominant one from roughly 400,000 years ago until 40,000 years ago. Their brains were large, their physical strength considerable. Remains of their bodies have been found scattered widely across Europe, even as far south as Gibraltar. Why they aren't still around remains a vexed question. Our conjectures about the Neanderthals began in 1856, when workers in a limestone quarry near Dusseldorf discovered a cave full of bones, some of abnormal bulk. A local naturalist with uncanny intuition thought the bones had to be from a primitive kind of human. He sent them in a chaperoned wooden box to an anatomist in Bonn, who inspected them and came to the same conclusion. In 1863, Professor William King, delivering a short paper to the British Association for the Advancement of Science, argued forcefully that the bones belong to a creature for whom we didn't yet have a name. He went on to propose one, Homo Neanderthalensis. Why that name? The valley where the bones were discovered had been a favorite spot for the wanderings of a 17th century polymath and nature lover whose family name had originally been Neumann before his ancestors rechristened themselves, faux classically, Neander. Neander was Greek for new man. Thal was German for valley. The valley of the new man. Could there be any more fitting moniker for the place where we first discovered another kind of human? Asked Rebecca Ragg Sykes, the author of Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art. The discovery of those bones and their naming in 1863 came at a time when Europe was coming to terms with the implications of the theories of Charles Darwin. On the Origin of Species had been published only 4 years earlier, and it was becoming harder to deny that the world was older, dramatically older than we had supposed. In The Naked Neanderthal, the French paleoanthropologist Ludovic Slimak reports encountering an anthropologist at Stanford who joked, while projecting a slide of a Neanderthal skull, that if I got on a plane and saw that the pilot had a head like that, I'd get off again. Blunter still was the Russian academic who kept insisting that Neanderthals were simply different. Different how? Ludovic, he said, they have no soul. A hypothesis dating back to the 1960s offers a vivid example of a kind of evidence that can be adduced for Neanderthal intelligence. A team led by Cambridge archaeologist Charles McBurney was excavating a seaside cliff on the Channel Island of Jersey. An early 20th century dig had already turned up remnants, in the form of surviving teeth, of Neanderthal occupation. But at the base of the cliff, they found an uncommonly large number of bones belonging to mammoth and rhinoceros. Why were they there? McBurney's field assistant, Catherine Scott, advanced an intriguing hypothesis. Could the bones be there because the mammoths had tumbled to their deaths from the high cliff that overlooked the graveyard? Scott pointed to evidence from surviving hunter-gatherer societies of drive lanes used to kill large numbers of bison. The Native American hunters who had been known to practice this kind of hunting used controlled grass fires to send the animals toward the cliff and carefully positioned hunters to keep the animals moving. Scott's hypothesis, if correct, attributes to Neanderthals some quite advanced cognitive capacities. This suggests a picture of Neanderthals as well-organized, cooperative killers with advanced communicative systems. The old picture of Neanderthals also proposed that they had, at best, a tenuous grasp of how fire worked. Perhaps they were able to use fire when they discovered it, but were unable to produce it when needed. But this is quite improbable. It is difficult to sustain the idea that a relatively furless species could have survived in Europe during the glacial periods when they appear to have thrived, without the mastery of fire. And so the archaeological record indeed suggests. Excavation sites are full of pieces of flint that show evidence of fire making. Charcoal remains at these sites indicate that they were keenest on using resin-rich pine wood as fuel, suggesting they had decided taste based on a long history of experimentation. They may have even have learned to use bones to prolong the life of a fire, keeping them warm while they slept. The study of ancient Neanderthal fires is itself a triumph of modern science. The name of the method, a mouthful, is fuliginochronology, a technique by which one turns a sooty cave into an archive, a veritable guestbook of Neanderthal inhabitation. A fire burning in a cave will leave a mark in the form of a nanoscale stripes, which, as Rags Sykes helpfully explains, are essentially tiny stratigraphics written in soot, formed when the fires of Neanderthals in residence smoked the roof and walls, leaving thin soot films. As one band of Neanderthals left the cave and another arrived and started a new fire, the pattern of soot would produce a sort of unique barcode. All these fires could hardly be the work of a species with a tenuous grasp of fire's workings. Last year, the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine was given to the scientist whose work has put a number to just how human the Neanderthals were. Svante Paabo, a Swedish geneticist, was a pioneer in the study of paleogenetics, which began with the discovery of how DNA might be extracted from a range of sources, old bones and teeth naturally, but also from cave sediments. Paabo managed to extract mitochondrial DNA from a piece of ancient bone, allowing him to publish in 1997 the first Neanderthal DNA sequence. 13 years later came the publication of a full Neanderthal genome based on DNA extracted from only 3 individuals. The genome offered strong support to what had previously been only a hypothesis, that Homo sapiens and the Neanderthals had had a common ancestor who lived about 600,000 years ago. More significantly, it showed that when early Homo sapiens had walked from their original home in Africa into Eurasia, they had encountered Neanderthals there and interbred with them. The Neanderthals were among the genetic ancestors of modern Europeans and Asians, but not of modern Africans. Eurasians today have between 1.5 and 2.1% Neanderthal DNA. Some readers of this research have found Paabo's conclusions a source of comfort. Those wondering what happened to the Neanderthals 40,000 years ago had long been tempted by a dark speculation. Perhaps we, Homo sapiens, with our superior weapons and new microbes, had killed them off. But Pabo's conclusions give an otherwise tragic story something of a silver lining. The Neanderthals are still alive as the archaic Homo sapiens they interbred with. They live on, to use an apt cliche, in us. They're very hybrid heirs. Not all Neanderthal researchers, though, draw such comfort from the DNA studies. Ludovic Slimak thinks the Neanderthals no more live on in us than an extinct wolf lives on in the poodle who shares sections of the archaic wolf genome. In Slimak's way of thinking about the question, the idea that there was no extinction, only a sort of dilution, is tantamount to a failure to see that Neanderthals were a genuinely other kind of humanity, neither better nor worse, and certainly not soulless. That humanity, he writes with a brutal brevity, is extinct, totally extinct. The unavoidable talk of humanity in these debates forces us to confront a more fundamental philosophical question of what exactly we take the human to mean in the first place. It is surprising just how affecting accounts of Neanderthal extinction can be, how often it moves otherwise sober science writers to unaccustomed pitches of lyricism. Being a responsible scientist, Rag Sykes is aware that ascribing any level of formal spirituality to Neanderthals would go far beyond the archaeological evidence. But she is convinced that we have enough evidence to be able to say that they, too, encountered all of life's sensory marvels. Perhaps as photons from a salmon-belly sunset saturated their retinas, or the groaning song of a mile-high glacier filled their ears, Neanderthals' brains translated this to something like awe. In puzzling over Neanderthals, we reveal something of ourselves. Why might some of us care so much about creatures so long extinct? No doubt part of the answer is that questions about the Neanderthals serve as proxies for questions about ourselves. The old fiction writer's choice between a picture of the Neanderthals as thugs and one of them as prototypical flower children no doubt reflects anxieties about human nature that have haunted the last few centuries of our history. Are we built for war or peace? It is, if anything, a part of human nature to resist the idea that our interests die with us, a part of our nature, and a beautiful one at that. And it makes one wonder. When the civilizations of Homo sapiens have been reduced to bones and rubble, will our successors on this planet, digging up our mounds of plastic waste, be as anxious to give us our due? This was adapted from a story originally published in The Guardian. Read one of the business columns this week. Reversals, the trial of Sam Bankman-Fried. Sam Bankman-Fried, one-time internet tycoon, is facing one of the most crucial moments of his life, said Ben Cockman in the New York Post, with a very, very Sam Bankman-Fried problem. His Adderall is wearing off. The mogul, on trial in New York City on 7 fraud-related counts that could put him in prison for life, griped through his lawyers this week that he had lost the ability to focus as he weighed the pivotal decision of whether to testify. The inability to focus may be par for the course for Bankman-Fried, who infamously misplaced some $8 billion in customer funds at his crypto brokerage, FTX, bragged about never reading books, and did televised interviews while playing video games. He has had to sit through the trial as former close associates ripped his behavior, and prosecutors showed off mementos of his better days, including photos of him with Katy Perry, Orlando Bloom, and Kate Hudson at the 2022 Super Bowl. It all reeked of excess and flashiness, one of his former top executives testified. For his close friends, relations with Bankman-Fried turned out to be very costly, said David Yaffe Bellany and J. Edward Moreno in the New York Times. When FTX collapsed in November, one of his oldest friends sent him a message of support. The message from Adam Yedida said, "I love you, Sam." Last week, Yedida showed up to testify for the prosecution. So did Bankman-Fried's girlfriend, Caroline Ellison, who was chief executive of the FTX-linked hedge fund Alameda Research. Yedida and others resigned when Bankman-Fried told them that FTX customers' money was used to repay FTX's debts. As for Ellison, she started cooperating with the prosecutors after the FBI raided her parents' home, even seizing her mother's electronic devices. The inner circle at FTX and Alameda were the people Bankman-Fried was closest to, said Elizabeth Lopato on The Verge. Even if the FTX mogul believed himself innocent, he probably could have spared his friends by taking responsibility and turning himself in. But that's not his way. Is Sam Bankman-Fried a psychopath? Asked Daniel Kuhn in CoinDesk. There's an emerging chorus of people who are willing to say bluntly that he is. But he is also a creature of his time in Silicon Valley, with its culture of blitzscaling, cutting any corner on the assumption that if you grow big fast, it will all work out. It's tempting to say, after watching how he treated those closest to him, that Bankman-Fried is uniquely unfeeling. Unfortunately, that misses all the reasons people like SBF keep popping up. So much for Bankman-Fried's effective altruism shtick, said Clive Cook in Bloomberg. Effective altruism was a moral system supposed to maximize human happiness, championed by largely self-anointed philosophers, with Bankman-Fried in the lead. Encouraging its practitioners to make money to eventually give away, it was presented as a fearless assault on the prevailing ethical complacency, daring to challenge embedded moral intuitions. Effective altruism promised to turn ethical decisions into a formula. It has turned out to be a fraud, just as opportunity for moral grandstanding for people with personality disorders. On the Talking Points page, we have Haley, the GOP's best Trump alternative. Watch out, Ron DeSantis, said Charlie Matheson and Calder McHugh in Politico. Nikki Haley's star is rising among Republican voters and conservative pundits, and the former South Carolina governor is on a trajectory to become the Trump alternative. After Haley's strong, steady performance in two GOP debates, polling support for the self-described moderate has doubled since this summer, and she is now outpolling DeSantis in New Hampshire and her home state, and has drawn into third place in Iowa. Her frugal campaign has left her with $9.1 million to spend in the primaries, nearly twice as large as DeSantis' primary war chest. More than anything, she has benefited from the dramatic flameout of DeSantis, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. Mainstream Republicans hoped the Florida governor would be a charismatic crusading figure who would repackage Trump's belligerent populism in a more palatable persona. To their dismay, they've learned that DeSantis is wooden, scripted, and incapable of talking to people like he's a human being. Donors have abandoned ship. Could Haley now consolidate the anti-Trump support in the GOP? Why not, says Kimberly Rost in the Washington Examiner. Haley's focused, sober attitude serves as a sharp contrast to her rivals, and as the 2017-2018 U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, she proves she doesn't wilt on the national or international stage. In the debate, she articulated a nuanced view of abortion emphasizing the need for consensus. Her gender could be an asset, and Biden strategists reportedly fear her most of any potential nominee. Haley is the presidential candidate the Republican Party desperately needs. Sorry, but Haley is likely to be another doomed champion for anti-Trump Republicans, said Ed Kilgore in New York Magazine. She still lags nearly 8 percentage points behind DeSantis in Iowa. More importantly, neither Haley, DeSantis, nor any other GOP presidential hopeful is within striking distance of Trump, who maintains a 40-plus point polling lead. In recent months, most Republican officials and voters have been treating Trump as though he's an incumbent president running for re-election instead of a serially discredited fraudster. To seriously challenge him, Haley would need to perform the impossible feat of sharpening her attacks on Trump without permanently alienating the MAGA base. Failing that, it's hard to see how she or anyone else represents a clear challenge to Trump. Gaza war, a foreboding glimpse of the future. The Gaza war may lead to a shift in the global balance of power, said Yaroslav Trofimov in the Wall Street Journal. Having long sought to undermine the U.S.-backed international system, Russia, China, and Iran see the conflict between Israel and Hamas as a major opportunity to drive a wedge between America and the rest of the world. Both China and Russia have pointedly failed to condemn Hamas or extend support to Israel. Instead, they have embraced the Palestinian cause. Russia, in particular, welcomes a conflict that could divert U.S. attention and military aid from Ukraine. To solidify their alliance, Russian President Vladimir Putin flew to Beijing this week to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping, said Robin Dixon in the Washington Post. Their deepening bond points to a hardening global fault lines, with an emerging axis of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea on one side, and the U.S. and its allies on the other. Let's face it, the Pax Americana of the post-Cold War period is over, said Hal Brands in Bloomberg. For a generation, America's role as sole superpower and global policeman help preserve relative geopolitical calm. But now China, Russia, and Iran are challenging American power and creating their own spheres of influence. China is bullying its neighbors in Asia with a showdown over Taiwan coming. Putin's barbaric war in Ukraine has alarmed and destabilized Europe. North Korea and Iran are providing arms to Russia, while Pyongyang perfects its long-range nuclear missiles, and Iran seeks nukes of its own. With conquest, ethnic cleansing, and mass migration spreading from the Balkans to Latin America to the Western Pacific, the international order is under more stress than at any time since the chaotic aftermath of World War II. In Israel and Ukraine, we are getting horrific glimpses of what a post-American world would look like, said Noah Rothman in National Review. The deliberate torture, rape, and slaughter of civilians suggest we are sliding back to a Hobbesian world in which human rights are irrelevant. America must marshal its resources to shore up the geopolitical order we long took for granted. Instead, we're mired in bitter division, political dysfunction, and growing isolationism that emboldens our enemies, said former Defense Secretary Robert M. Gates in Foreign Affairs. The peril is real, and the U.S. needs to up its game before it's too late. Here's a few of the shorter notes. High schoolers' scores on the ACT college admissions test have dropped to their lowest since 1991. Scores have been dipping for the past 6 years, but the fall accelerated sharply during the pandemic. Only one-fifth of the class of 2023 met all college readiness benchmarks in English, math, reading, and science. In the 12 months through September, U.S. officials recorded 60 migrant deaths due to heat in the Border Patrol's El Paso sector, triple the number from a year earlier. Temperatures in El Paso topped 100 degrees for a record streak of 44 days this summer. Some 7 million Americans have received the new COVID-19 booster since it became available in September, according to the CDC, which recommends the booster for everyone ages 6 months and up. By comparison, more than 18 million people received last year's bivalent booster in its first 6 weeks of availability. On the poll watch, 52% of Americans say the U.S. is spending too much money on Ukrainian aid, including 37% of Democrats and 69% of Republicans. And we will finish today's show with a quote from Albert Camus, quoted in The Whig from Canada, who says, "Autumn is a second spring when every leaf is a flower." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.